It's your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC for 20 great years has the best OTR on our live streaming. And continue tuning in to the Radio Book Channel, along with the RTC Music Channel, all at oldtimeradiolisten.com.
I'm Jim Dolan, and welcome to the podcast. It's been a while since we've had a great detective, and one of the greatest is Philip Marlowe. We've got a program here to play for you today. 30 minutes of excitement, if you will. This one's called The Black Halo, and it comes from 1949.
Somewhere in the cold, persistent rain that made the city itself seem a thing of evil, a girl had disappeared, and it was my job to find her. But before I did, I found death and a devil.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of crime fiction, comes his most famous character as CBS presents The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. And now, with Gerald Moore, starred as Philip Marlowe, we bring you tonight's exciting story, The Black Halo.
For 3 days, an ugly storm had lashed at the west coast from northern Oregon to the tip of lower California. And although it was only noon when I drove up to the sprawling red brick house just south of Santa Barbara to meet a new client of mine, the black that was in the sky and the driving rain that was everywhere left the day bleak and wet and cold. Left it the kind of day that made you feel that logs blazing in a fireplace and a warm, dry robe were the only things that could matter to anyone. But when I got inside the house, Felix Drum, 350 uncomfortable pounds of executive in a wheelchair, who made his living importing perfumes, was very worried. And not about the weather outside.
Marlowe, Julia Perry is gone. I want you to find her and bring her back. And the sooner you do that, the better.
And the more I know, Mr. Drum, the easier it'll be. Exactly who is Julia Perry?
My assistant. Very capable girl, who in the past 6 months has practically taken over my entire business. She handles most of the work from her cottage here on the grounds where she lives.
Mm-hmm.
She also has some little cubbyhole in Los Angeles where she keeps her files and some sample stock.
Do you have the address of that cubbyhole?
If I knew the answer to everything, I wouldn't have hired you. And anyway, it isn't important. Hand me that little bottle.
This one? Please.
Yes.
No, here.
Thank you.
When did you last see Julia, Mr. Drum?
3 days ago. Oh. It was 3 days ago, when she left on one of her regular weekly trips down to Los Angeles to bid on perfumes. Usually she stayed away overnight, but the Beachwood Plaza Hotel most of the time, and she was back here by noon the next day.
I suppose you've already checked the Beachwood Plaza, huh?
Yes, of course. My man Ruby, the one who showed you in, has called the place a dozen times. But they only know that Julia registered there 3 days ago and hasn't been seen since.
Well, what about the girl herself, Mr. Drum? I mean her background, friends, family, that sort of thing.
Yeah, as far as I know, Marlowe, Julia has no friends, no family either. She's just a sweet but smart little girl from someplace in Kansas.
Mm-hmm, no beaux, not even nice ones, huh?
I don't think she had the time. You see, when Julia first came to work for me, she wanted to get ahead, and I gave her the chance. She made good.
Mm-hmm.
Today, she's as much my right arm as Ruby is my leg.
Mr. Drum, did you notice anything unusual about Julia's behavior lately?
Yes, and that's the reason I'm worried. About 2 weeks ago, I saw changes in the girl, Marlowe. She seemed less spry, more preoccupied.
Oh?
Yes. I figured it was overwork myself, since the end of the year always means detailed annual reports. So I made no comment at the time.
I see. Tell me, Mr. Drum, what does she look like?
Well, I have no pictures, but she's a blonde of medium height and was wearing a plaid raincoat and a little circle of a hat when she left.
Uh-huh.
Altogether, she's sweet and simple, if that's what you mean.
Yeah. Do you mind if I stop into the cottage on my way out?
Marlowe, you turn the place inside out, if it'll help any. Only since I'm certain that Julia's in some kind of bad trouble, you be quick and find her.
Julia Perry's cottage was strictly the 50-50 arrangement that Drum had mentioned, with one room office and the other living quarters. In the office, I found everything in its proper place, so I moved to the other room. The moment I stepped over the threshold, the white fluff that trimmed the quilted bedspread and the splash of color in the drapes said that Julia Perry had to be something soft and warm. And the half a dozen quietly tailored suits that were lined up in the closet like a squad of soldiers facing right told me that she was also simple and neat. I ran through the pockets of her clothes and all the drawers and closets in the room, trying to find something that would give me a lead that I was sure I had to have. But after 20 minutes, I'd found only a leather cigarette case, a package of peppermint lifesavers, and a maroon and gold monogram book of matches, the cover of which was half torn off so that I could only be certain that the middle initial was a V and that an E or an F were on either end. But since the name and address of an L.A. novelty company was on the inside, I bought the matches as a starting point, dropped them into my pocket, and headed for the door. When I opened it, I was surprised to find Ruby, Drum's right-hand man, purple scar and all, standing in the rain, staring at me like my ears were spinning.
You seem to be a very thorough man, Mr. Private Detective.
And you seem to be a very nosy one. What do you want?
To help Julia, nothing else. Here's a postcard that came for her this morning. It was mailed in L.A. yesterday.
Yeah? Dear Julia, tried to reach you at Santa Barbara 1181 both yesterday and today, but got no answer. I'm leaving town tomorrow. As one little girl who fled life in Haven, Kansas, to another, I would have enjoyed seeing you again. For a bit before I moved on to who knows where. Anne. Santa Barbara 1181, is that the number here?
Yeah, it's Julia's private business phone. Well, what do you think, the postcard, any help?
Possibly. Tell me, Ruby, why didn't you show this to Mr. Drum?
I forgot about it until just now.
You're a liar.
Well, it's on account of the postcard was delivered here to the cottage.
Which is no man's land for you?
Yeah, sort of. Mr. Drum doesn't like people who work for him mixing socially with each other.
Well, maybe a sweet kid like Julia hasn't got any use for the passes you've been making at her, huh?
Hold it. I like Julia, and even if she don't go for me, anything I can do to help her, I still do, understand?
Yeah, I understand. I'm not so sure I believe. Goodbye, Ruby. It was pushing 5 o'clock and still raining by the time I got back to L.A. and over to the novelty company. Once there, I presented the torn book of matches that I had found in Julia's cottage to a bald man with horizontal question marks for eyebrows, and who, at the crinkle of a $5 bill, tore himself away from his racing form long enough to check the files for a set of maroon and gold initials that had a V in the middle. And it was 6 o'clock before I had the answer, which was E.V.E. And they weren't initials, but the front name of Mrs. Eve Bentley, who lived in a villa at the swank Sunset Terrace Apartments. And according to the gentleman who said he knew his oats, was a very classy filly. An hour later, I was at Mrs. Bentley's front door, and while I made with the chimes and waited, I wondered just how much a guy who loves the ponies could know about women. But when the door opened, I had my answer.
Yes? What is it?
Mrs. Eve Bentley wasn't beautiful, but she was everything else, including a shimmering yard of gold hair piled high on her head, and held in place by a knot of pearls that no Boy Scout ever tied. Her face was wide blue eyes and open red lips on a backdrop of soft, fair skin. She wore a black silk jersey dress that must have been sprayed on. She smiled when I said my name was Philip Marlowe and that I wanted to talk.
Talk about what, Mr. Marlowe?
Julia Perry. Ever hear of her?
No, I haven't.
So I'll try again. What do you know about Anne somebody from Haven, Kansas?
Absolutely nothing.
This torn book of matches says otherwise. I found them in Julia Perry's cottage. Julia Perry's missing. I'm a private detective who was hired to find her, and the matches turned out to be yours. Now, may I come in?
Why, yes.
Thanks. Now, Mrs. Bentley, maybe we ought to start all over.
No, wait just a minute, Mr. Marlowe. I may be able to help you. Did this Julia Perry deal in perfumes?
That's right. Now, how did you know that?
Because I just remembered something. And now I'm sure I can explain why my matches showed up where
just
they did.
Just a minute. You know, whenever I'm talking to a beautiful woman, somebody's always creeping around in the kitchen. Who is it this time?
Oh, really, Mr. Marlowe? There's a storm outside, and there are windows and trees. You put those three things together, that noise could have been a branch scratching on a glass pane.
Or somebody with squeaky shoes and a lot of curiosity. Somebody like Mr. Bentley, for instance.
Oh, I doubt that, Mr. Marlowe. You see, Mr. Bentley's been dead now for 3 long years.
Oh, yes. Well, you were saying something about the matches.
Oh, yes. This Julia Perry must somehow have other gotten hold of them through my fiancé, Marvin Whittaker.
How does that figure?
Like 2 and 2. Marvin is in the perfume business. Ditto Julia. Also, I think he mentioned her name once. Said she was very clever for a girl who looked like somebody's kid sister.
That fits all right. Where will I find said fiancé?
At his favorite bar and grill. But won't you have a drink first, Mr. Marlowe?
No, thanks, Eve. There isn't time. Now the bar and grill.
The Blue Boar.
Blue which?
Boar, Mr. Marlowe.
Yeah.
It's a very English spot over on Wilshire, opposite Arthur Murray's studio. But before you dash, do you at least have a match?
Yeah. Whole book of them, honey. Torn cover and all. And I want you to keep them. After all, they brought us together, didn't they? When I got outside, I postponed my run between the raindrops over to Wilshire Boulevard long enough to take a look behind the villa. And there, in a newly planted strip of clover lawn below Mrs. Bentley's kitchen window, I found something which was no surprise. 2 clear prints of a man's shoe. But from there on out, I got nothing more than a lot of rain down the back of my neck. So 10 minutes later, I dripped into my car and headed for the Blue Boar and Eve Bentley's gentleman friend. I located Marvin Whittaker, a handsome, hale fellow well met, in a white turtleneck sweater and riding breeches, behind a hot rum toddy in a corner booth that was pictures of steeplechase mounts against newly antique mahogany. And when I told him that I was looking for Julia Perry, he flashed a lot of glistening teeth at me, insisted that I join him in a warming glass of spirits, and started to talk, gesturing all the time with a riding crop.
Why, yes, old man, I know Julia Perry. In fact, almost did some business with her today.
You mean you were supposed to meet Julia someplace?
That's right, at 1881 Selma Avenue, to be precise. But she called me this morning and postponed the whole transaction, indefinitely.
Could you stop projecting long enough to tell me why?
She didn't say. Of course, it's of no bother to me on a day like this. No sane man should be any farther away from a toddy than we are right now. So drink up, old boy. It'll do you a world of good.
Yeah, I bet it will. Look, Mr. Whittaker, one more question. Did Julia ever speak of a girlfriend named Ann? Someone she knew years ago in Kansas?
No, I don't believe she did, Marlowe. Matter of fact, Julia never talked of anything but perfumes. Now drink your drink, fellow, before it's chilled through.
Thanks, but no thanks, old bean. I do have to run, really. It was a 20-minute drive to the address on Selma, and the rain had stopped by the time I got there. The place was one of those once-upon-a-time rooming houses that had been partitioned off into a couple of dozen 2x4 cubbyholes. Just big enough for the very small businessman to fill his fountain pen in. When I got to the door and asked the scrub woman, who was a lot of wild red hair around 2 pop eyes for Julia Perry, I knew I was moving in the right direction because the lady standing in front of me was anything but calm. And more important, she had just heard a pistol shot from the back of the house.
Yes, that's right. A pistol shot not over 2 minutes ago. I'm sure that Perry girl had something to do with it. Because when I come from inside, I saw her rush out down these steps.
Did she say anything?
I don't know. She was gone out of sight before I could open my mouth. But I know it was her on account of that plaid coat and little hat she wears.
Yeah. Now, which room is hers? Come on.
Well, that one there with the light showing under the door.
Mm-hmm.
But it's locked. She won't be able to get in. I just tried.
Well, we'll try again for luck. It's not the best lumber. Believe me.
This has ever happened to me before. It's a man.
Yeah. A dead one at that, Granny.
Do you know who it is?
Uh-huh. From the mud and clover grass on the bottom of his shoes, I'd tag him as a guy who was looking in a lady's kitchen window about an hour ago. But from that purple scar on his chin, I can do even better than that. The name, Granny, is Ruby, a guy I thought was still in Santa Barbara.
In just a moment, we will return to the second act of The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. But first, given clues, even the newest of Philip Marlowe fans can deduce the characters in CBS's great new early Sunday evening comedy lineup. The washboard leads you to the one and only Spike Jones. The bumblebee? Well, of course, that's for America's most famous non-virtuoso violinist, Jack Benny, who follows Spike Jones on CBS. The two A's, Amos and Andy, who are heard on CBS immediately following Jack Benny. So it's really no mystery at all why millions of Americans now stay tuned to CBS on Sunday nights for these three superb comedy shows in succession. Spike Jones and Amos and Andy over most of these same CBS stations, and Jack Benny over them all. And now, with our star, Gerald Moore, we return to the second act of Philip Marlowe and tonight's story, The Black Halo.
Ruby's body sprawled on the floor, and the girl in the plaid raincoat running away from it meant one thing. Julia Perry's trouble was important, like life, but more like death. A half-sneer was congealed on Ruby's face, and his eyes turned waxy, still held a look of mild surprise. And I wasted some breath telling the scrub woman not to touch anything, and then I put in a call to my overweight client in Santa Barbara. He was glad to hear from me, at first.
Marlowe, well, now, I didn't expect a call from you this soon. You sure work fast, don't you, lad? Have you found her? Have you located Julia?
Not quite. She's about 5 minutes ahead of me. Incidentally, Mr. Drum, she works fast, too.
What do you mean by that?
Let me ask the questions, huh? Number one, what was your leg man, Ruby, doing in L.A. tonight?
Ruby?
Yeah.
Why, I sent him in to pick up some medicine for me. Why?
Come on, Drum, you can talk straighter than that, and you better. I just found Ruby dead.
Dead? Ruby's dead? What happened to him, Marlowe?
He was shot. So forget the gags and tell me why he was snooping around.
All right. I didn't trust you.
No.
It's my policy to trust nobody until he proves himself. I sent Ruby in to follow you and check on your progress.
That was brilliant. You only made three mistakes. First, I don't need to be checked on. Second, you got your man killed. And third, you forced Julia's hand. Because it was Miss Perry herself who pulled the trigger on Ruby.
Julia? Marlowe, I don't believe that.
Which proves nothing, Mr. Drum, but skip it. Tell me, do you know a man named Marvin Whittaker?
Whittaker?
Yeah.
Oh, should I?
Well, he says he's in the perfume business.
Well, I know everybody on the coast who bought more than 2 bottles of perfume at one time in the last 40 years, and I don't recall that name. I think the man must be a liar.
So do I. Thanks for the help. And Drum, if you've got any more expendable flunkies around, keep them out of my hair. I'll call you when I've got something. I called Homicide next and told Detective Lieutenant Ibarra where to find the body and who was responsible for it being in that dead condition. When the question of why came up, I admitted I was still shooting blanks. Oh, I told him about the razzle-dazzle Whittaker had handed me and named the Blue Boar on Wilshire as my next stop. Ibarra said he'd call me there, and when I got to the entrance of the place, I saw Whittaker, draped in a trench coat that involved enough cloth to rig a four-masted schooner, standing in the anteroom, impatiently smacking his leg with that riding crop. He looked positively dashing. Question was, which way?
Hiya there, Marlowe. Hey, old boy, you look upset. Anything wrong?
I may be upset, Whittaker, but you're the one that's going to spill. First, are you leaving or coming back?
I'm just leaving.
Been here all the time since I talked to you?
That's right, you see. My coat is perfectly dry.
It stopped raining half an hour ago.
Well, you see, if I'd been outside, I would have known that. But why this third degree, Marlowe? What's up?
It's a long story. Maybe we better sit down and talk it all over from the beginning.
Oh, I'm afraid I can't. Not just now. I've got a date.
She'll keep.
Not this one. It's something rather special.
Special, huh? Like Eve Bentley?
Now, look here, old boy. You're prying into my personal affairs.
Whittaker, I'll rip the lid clear off your personal affairs if necessary to get a clean answer out of you. Now, what do you really know about Julia Perry?
I told you once. Are you implying that I'm a liar?
At least that. For instance, who puts out Amir? Come on, Whittaker. It's a well-known fragrance.
Why, I don't recall offhand.
That's strange, because any woman knows Amir's a Dana perfume.
Just what are you trying to prove by all this?
That it's a perfume dealer, you stink. And try this for size. When I got to that address you gave me, I found a fresh corpse there with a bullet hole in it.
A murder?
Yeah, and your routine was pat, brother. So before Homicide starts combing out the snags in your story, you better untangle it yourself right now. You lied to me. And why'd you do it, Whittaker? Why the double talk?
All right, Marlowe, I'll tell you. I'll tell you this! Oh!
He was as quick as a wounded cat. The riding crop slashed across my face even before I'd realized he'd moved. And by the time the red light stopped dancing in my eyes, Marvin Whittaker was gone. I turned as the head waiter walked up to me. He studied the hot red welt rising on my face for a moment and then murmured discreetly that if my name was Marlowe, I was wanted on the phone. It was Lieutenant Ibarra.
Marlowe, you can stop beating the brush for Judy Perry. We found her.
You did? Where is she, Ibarra?
She's out in the alley here behind the Beechwood Plaza Hotel, Marlowe. Exactly 8 floors down from the window of her room. She fell through the glass roof above the rear entrance.
Oh.
It's not pretty.
Oh.
She explained the whole thing, including that Ruby guy's murder, in a note we found in her room.
I'll be right over, Ibarra.
Okay, don't hurry.
The old story, Marlowe. When Drum finally got around to trusting her, he practically gave her his business. It was too much temptation.
Mm-hmm.
She'd been stealing from him in a big way for almost a year, her note says.
And she decided to run for it when she knew she couldn't hide the thefts any longer, huh?
That's right. That Ruby caught on some way and she killed him, but I guess murder was too rich for her blood, so she came back here, thought it over, and checked out.
Yeah. All she left behind was a little plaid raincoat and a purse over there. Hey, she was wearing a dinky hat, too, Ibarra. Did you find that?
Mm-hmm. Come over here to the window, Phil. See down there on that canopy, that little black circle? That's her hat. I sent Mooney down to get it. Can't leave any loose ends around, you know?
Yeah. Got a light, Lieutenant?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Thanks.
Hey, what happened to you? That welt on your face, Phil.
Oh, I backed that horsey liar named Whitaker into a corner, and he slapped his way out with a riding crop. And speaking of loose ends, if I ever catch up with that... Ibarra, where did that stuff on the dresser come from?
Well, this out of the pockets of Judy's plaid coat. Why?
But that's impossible unless... Holy smoke. That's why Whitaker lied to me.
Hey, where are you going with that, Phil? Come back here.
I got to check on something, Ibarra, and keep your notebook handy. If I'm right, this deal is still wide open.
All the way from the suicide's room in the Beechwood Plaza out to the widow's villa in the Sunset Terrace, my mind juggled a jumble of facts trying to beat them into a brand new pattern. A pattern that had to include an object Ibarra had found in the pocket of that plaid raincoat. It almost made sense. I needed just a little more. Well, when I turned into the parking lot at the Sunset Terrace, rain began to fall again. Thin, cold rain. I walked to Eve Bentley's door and pressed the bell. Just as I expected, it was Marvin Whitaker, unsmiling and nervous, who answered the door. I didn't give him a chance to think. I just swung hard! Okay, horseman, that squares us up. Come on, heavy, roll over. Let's see if you're carrying a gun. Okay, no gun. Now, be a good boy, Whitaker, and you'll make out all right, but one funny wiggle out of you and I'll crack your skull. It's a promise. Do you hear me?
Yeah, I heard you.
All right. Now, where's Eve? Is she here?
Find out for yourself, Marlowe. I'm through.
Fair enough. But just so I'm not talking through my head, I'll take a look in her closet first.
She won't be in there, I guarantee.
No, but her future might be. Now, let's see. It's got to be in here someplace. Oh, yeah. This is probably it. Brown cloth coat, as chic as a pair of hobnailed boots, and still damp. And the label says the BH Company, Haven, Kansas. That does it. I've got it all now, and my chivalry just died. Where is she, Whitaker? Where's Eve?
Right here, Marlowe. Uh-oh, don't try that. I guess you really do have it figured out, haven't you?
Yes, Eve, I have. Sorry it turned out this way, because you had your points, as Eve and as Julian.
Don't put it in the past tense, Marlowe. As Eve Bentley, my life is just beginning, and now I've got everything I ever wanted as Julia Perry.
Then you're Julia Perry.
I was, Marvin.
She still is, Whitaker. At least that's what the bailiff will call it in court.
There won't be any court, Marlowe.
Oh, I'm afraid there will, baby. You're twice a killer now, and both for the same reason, remember? First Ruby, because he saw you as Eve. And the girl you pushed out of the hotel window, who was no doubt Anne, your old chum from the hometown. She must have seen you posing as Eve, too.
All right, Marlowe. Anne ran into me by accident and ruined everything. I had no choice. I promised her money and then told her to go to my room at the Beechwood Plaza and wait for me.
Eve, I can't believe this. It can't be true.
Yes, Marvin, it is true. Darling, I didn't want this mess. I'd have left town this morning as I intended if sweet, sly little Anne hadn't seen me. I tried to get rid of you the easy way, Marlowe. When I sent you to Marvin, the Selma Street address he gave you should have led you to the end of Julia Perry.
Is that why you phoned me and told me to lie to Marlowe?
Yes, Marvin. I was going there to write my suicide note and use the stockroom for my disappearing act. But Ruby caught me, and after that I had to work fast. But it's all right now. It all worked out perfectly. They were the only two who knew besides you, Marlowe.
Aren't you forgetting little Marvin here?
Forgetting him? Oh, no, Mr. Marlowe. Marvin's the one person I can count on.
That's what you think. You don't get me mixed up in this.
Marvin!
I bargained for an heiress, not a murderess.
Why, you dirty load! All right, then. I'll use this gun on you, too, because I'm getting out of here and no one's going to stop me.
But you're right between us, Eve. You can't get us both.
He's right, baby. You're not good enough to get us both, and killing just one of us isn't going to solve anything. What do you say? It's been a long night, baby. You just couldn't tell when you were late.
You want any more of this coffee, Marlowe?
No, it's sludge, Lieutenant. I wonder what Julia Perry uses for a heart.
You know, she planned the thing for 6 months when she first set herself up as Eve Bentley. And it probably would have...
Did you check now?
Oh, yes.
Probably would have worked if everything hadn't closed in on her.
Yeah, her friend Ann from Kansas, Ruby the leg man.
And you with that torn book of matches. Incidentally, that was pretty fast figuring up in the hotel room there, Marlowe.
Oh, not so fast, Ibarra. I knew Eve had those matches because I left them with her. So when you found the same matches in the pocket of Julia's plaid coat, it figured Julia almost had to be Eve.
And that left Anne to furnish the body for the suicide.
Yeah. You know, I wasn't so sure about that until I found the brown coat with the Haven, Kansas label in Eve's apartment.
Yeah. Well, I'd better wait on back to the office, Phil. Look at that rain come down. Think it'll ever stop?
I don't know. I doubt it.
Oh, by the way, here, it's her hat. Mooney finally got it down off that hotel canopy. Maybe you'd like it for a souvenir.
Yeah.
The military people call it a halo hat. Good night, Marlowe.
I sat there a while after Ibarra left, looking at the rain in the street, and the cold coffee in front of me, and Julia's little round halo on the table. And finally I got up and went outside. Dirty water scudded along the gutter and gurgled thickly into the sewer drain at the corner. For a minute I caught a glimpse again of the girl I'd figured Julia Perry to be when I went through her cottage in Santa Barbara. Yeah, that girl was an angel. When I finally caught up with her, a halo turned out to be black, jet black, inside and out. I dropped the little hat into the gutter and watched it go as far as the drain at the corner. And then I went home.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, created by Raymond Chandler, stars Gerald Moore and is produced and directed by Norman McDonald. Script is by Mel Donnelly, Robert Mitchell, and Gene Levitt. Featured in the cast were Joan Banks, Paul Frees, Peter Leeds, Jack Prussian, and Lois Corbett. Lieutenant Detective Ibarra is played by Jeff Corey. The special music was by Richard Orant. Be sure and be with us again next week when Philip Marlowe says...
A startled corpse, a blue-eyed woman, and a cryptic message scrawled by a dingy man with the pieces of a Chinese puzzle that wouldn't fit together until I found out what was deadly about the orange dog.
You'll find a whole hour of fun, variety, music, and thrills on Sing It Again tonight and every Saturday, for it's heard over most of these same CBS network stations. Now, stay tuned for Gangbusters, which follows immediately over most of these same stations. This is Roy Rowan speaking for CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Our next program involves the television anchor, Walter Cronkite, that used to anchor the CBS Evening News. And, of course, he was in World War II as a reporter earlier in his career. And I guess he has a story to tell us called Dry Martini. This is Soldiers of the Press from 1943.
Soldiers of the Press. This week, Dry Martini.
This is Reichsrundfunk, DJW Berlin speaking. We almost got the American bomber ace Martini on Monday. We'll get him next time if he dares come back over Europe again.
Oh, get a load of that fathead, Heine. That fat punk Goering, he and his whole Air Force are washed up, and yet they challenge us to come out and fight.
That lousy microphone
jockey. There's a dramatic story behind that Berlin radio challenge to the heroic crew of the Flying Fortress Dry Martini. It's a story that comes to us from United Press correspondent Walter Cronkite. Recently, you heard Cronkite's story of his own flight with a fortress bombing Wilhelmshaven. Cronkite is assigned to a Flying Fortress base somewhere in England, and he knows the men of the plane whose name is Dry Martini, and whose insignia is a brimming cocktail glass. This is the story of one of those men, told by United Press correspondent Walter Cronkite.
The crews that fly America's Flying Fortresses are among the best trained combat teams in the fighting forces. They're keen, alert, and every man knows his job like he'd been born for it. What's more, they're all swell guys, regular, fun-loving. Real American lads who have a grim and dangerous job to do and do it. And they ask nothing better than a chance to keep on carrying the fight to the enemy and the skies over Europe. Second Lieutenant Woody Clark is one of those guys. He's a navigator and a good one. His ship is the Dry Martini. I met him outside operations headquarters that Monday morning, just before the briefing began. A cold wind was sweeping across the field. And a fine rain was falling. Hiya, Woody.
What's good about it?
I didn't say anything was good about it. Matter of fact, I think it's a stinking morning. That make you feel any better?
Well, at least it's a realistic attitude.
Okay, we're realistic. So suppose you tell me the correct time.
Look, what's the matter, Cronkite? Can't you manage a watch that'll tell time on your expense account?
Hi, Woody.
Hey,
hi,
what's eating you this morning anyway? All I ask for is the time. You act like I was asking you for the secret of the Norden bomb site.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess I'm just on edge. Okay, get out that Waterbury of yours and we'll set up.
All right.
It's, hi, kids. 5:47 less 15 seconds. Less 10. Less 5. Got it?
Check. Thanks.
Okay.
You know, I don't blame you for being jumpy. I've only been up on one mission, and I'm not making this one, but I can't help getting butterflies every time.
Oh, it's not that exactly. I guess I'm sore at myself more than anything else.
What did you do, buy a half interest in Buckingham Palace last trip to London?
No, I just haven't clipped any coupons off Goering Preferred in about a dozen trips out. I'm beginning to think I don't know how to use that pea shooter I got up there in the greenhouse.
So that's what's bothering you. You haven't claimed any German planes yet.
Yep, I guess that's it. Everyone else with a gun station aboard the Dry Martinis picked off at least one. Well, I'm beginning to feel self-conscious.
Now, isn't that too bad? No Fokker Wolfs or Messerschmitts to your credit. Don't you consider it a bit of an accomplishment to bring that $750,000 kite home safe each time?
Well, I still want to claim an enemy plane. I'm going to do it this time, too, or I'm going to ask for service with a ground crew.
You'll nail one, Woody. I can feel it. We'll celebrate with an honest-to-God steak. Now, come on, snap out of it.
Thanks, Mother. I guess I'm just the moody type.
Come on, you guys. Pile in and look alive. Briefing's about to begin.
Come on, Cronkite. Let's go.
Right.
Okay, men. Pipe down and perk up. Now, as I told you last night, our objective is Paris in the spring. But there won't be any tra-la-tra-la atmosphere about it. You all know the importance of this raid. It's a tough assignment. You know your plan of attack, and you've all had your instructions. So there's no need to go into that again. You'll have fighter protection going out to the limit of their range.
and they'll pick you up at the same approximate point on your return. Intelligence reports there isn't much flak over Paris, but Goering's boys will throw the book at you coming back.
Question. What about these fragmentation bombs the German fighter planes have been using against fortresses?
They may employ them again. Probably will. But experience indicates they're no more effective than AK-AK fire. If one explodes near you, it's bad. But your principal worry will be the enemy fighter.
You'll take off. As the briefing continued, covering point-by-point instructions, I made notes like the pilots and crews. The information available at a briefing is mighty valuable when you start writing your story of the raid. I could see Woody grimly scribbling on his pad. I could tell he was still tense and sore. The target for the day was the big Renault plant near Paris, used by the Germans as an aircraft engine factory. The promise of heavy opposition from enemy pursuits indicated that Woody would have ample opportunity to try for the scalp of one of Goering's boys. The briefing lasted more than half an hour before the wing commander said,
"That's all, unless there are other questions." "Very well, then. School's out. Go on out and turn them over. And drop those bombs right down the smokestacks."
"Bye, Woody, and good luck. I'll have that steak waiting for you, so do your stuff."
"Okay, I like them rare and 2 inches thick."
As the crews piled into the waiting trucks that would take them to their planes, I made my way to the bomber wing headquarters. It was raining. I wiped the moisture from the window that overlooked the field. The planes were taxiing onto the runways. I could see their green and red recognition lights dimly through the fog. One by one, I could see them race down the runway. Then the first one zoomed directly overhead and faded into the dawn. They came over in rapid succession after that. Their motors blended into a continuous roar that died away gradually. The dry martini was on her way, with Woody up there in the greenhouse, busy with his charts and instruments. There was nothing to do now but wait. I walked back to the operations office. "All off on time, Hap?"
"Yeah, take off smooth as clockwork."
"What time they due over the target?"
0820.
"Mind if I park myself here and keep an eye on the show?"
"Of course not. Pull up a chair, make yourself comfortable. Long wait."
The operations office is the heart of a bomber base. In it, intelligence and operations officers lay out the objectives and plot the flights. Over its battery of phones, reports come in from the aircraft spotters on the movements of planes, our own and the enemy. And through it move all the reports on every mission. Across one end of the room spreads a huge map, and on it, big black-headed pins mark the position of every bomber in the squadron. Every 15 minutes, the time is called off, and the pins are moved into new positions.
"Time 715. Map reference H3207.
They're out over the channel now and high upstairs, 30,000 feet in the frigid thin air of the substratosphere. I listen to the reports come in and watch the black pins edging toward the target. They pass Boulogne, Abbeville, Amiens, Saint-Denis.
"Time 0810. Map reference Q4360.
They're 10 minutes from the target now. Up in the glass-in nose of the bomber, it's time for Woody to put aside the charts and get set behind that pea shooter of his. For it's a cinch to be tough from here on. I stick around until the pins are directly over Paris. I go outside for smoke and a cup of coffee and try to relax. The hands of my watch seem to crawl. But I know they're on their way back now, and I keep wondering if Woody is having any luck against Goering's boys. At 10 a.m., I duck into operations. Hello, Hap. How's it going?"
"Fighter escort took off half an hour ago to meet him. We should be hearing from him any time now."
"That'll be a relief. You know, in some ways, it's tougher staying behind than it is being up there. You can dream up too many things here. Up there, you're too busy to do much thinking about anything but essential business."
"Yeah, I know."
"Hello? Yes? Yes? Okay, got it. Spotter reports a large flight of 4 motored bombers identified as fortresses just crossed the coast. They're coming home."
The ground crews are heading out for the field now, and the runways are being cleared for landing. I begin to feel better.
About time for them to be checking with the tower.
"Blue Leader to Blue Leader Control Tower. Blue Leader to Blue Leader Control Tower. Come in. Come in, please."
"Blue Tower here. Hello, Blue Leader. Go ahead, please. Over."
"Blue Squadron requests permission to land. Over."
"Blue Leader from Tower. Okay to land. Using number 1, 3, and 4 runways. Wind is west, 16 miles. You bringing them all home?
No, sorry, no such luck. Army 29041 dropped out of formation. She had one motor afire and reported she couldn't keep up. Off.
Army 29041. I look at the operations chart and my heart skips a beat. Army 29041 is the dry martini. The planes are coming in now. Their motors a distant rumble. It grows larger, and then they're visible. The sun has come through, and you can see its dull reflection on the green-gray of their wings. We watch them land and see the pilots and crews getting the kinks out of their legs as they head for the briefing room to make out the reports. But I keep thinking of the dry martini. Out there somewhere trying to horse it in with one motor gun.
Time, 1030. All planes except Army 29041 down safely.
Anything from the spotters?
No, not a thing.
We sit silent and tense now and watch the clock. The sweep second hand on the clock in front of Hap seems to creep around the dial.
Blue control tower to Army 29041. Blue control tower to Army 29041. Can you hear me? Come in. Come in. Come in.
No answer.
Yep. Looks bad. I was talking to Woody Clark before they took off this morning. He was down because he hadn't claimed an enemy plane. I hope he got one.
Yeah, I hope he did.
Promised a mistake if he did. Guess I'd better go start lining it up. They're not easy to produce.
Yeah, take some doing.
Blue Leader Control Tower from Army 29041.
Boy, is that
good
news.
Control Tower from Army 29041. Acknowledge. Over.
Tower here. Hello, Army 29041. We'd begun to think you'd washed out. Over.
No, we're going to make it. Coming in for a landing. Request your instructions. Over.
Army 29041 from tower. Okay to land. Number 2 runway is clear to land. Any wounded aboard?
Nothing we can't walk away. But you better have an ambulance on hand. We got a left wing like a sieve and one motor's conked out. I may mess things up a bit in landing. Over and off.
Okay, Army 29041. Here's luck. Off.
I dashed for the door and hopped aboard the ambulance that was heading for runway number 2. She was coming in now. From the ground, we could see the smoke pouring from one motor and holes the size of a washtub through her tail surfaces. She wobbled as she came down. Her wheels touched. She lurched uncertainly. Then she righted herself and jolted to a stop. I looked at the nose. The windows in Woody's greenhouse were shot out. The pilot's windshield was shattered. The glass was gone from the tail. The cowling of 2 of the good motors was riddled. Then the crew began piling out.
Sorry, Doc. No business for you.
Yeah, Doc. You can roll that butcher wagon back in the barn.
Well, that's the way we like it.
Have a tough time?
Yeah, but a good one. We got 12 planes, Doc.
Well, how do you like that? 12 planes.
Lieutenant Clark rates top score. He got 3.
Woody got 3. Man. Then I saw him poking his head through the hatch. His face was cut a bit from flying glass, but he was grinning.
Oh, Cronkite. Got that steak ready?
Brother, you sure rate it. What came over you, anyhow?
Oh, they made me mad, I guess. They put 2 explosive caliber 30s right through the nose.
Yeah, I noticed.
Pieces of metal bounced off my steel helmet. They didn't hurt either me or the bombardier. Bullet hit my gun mount. Then I really began shooting. The next Focke-Wulf that came in, I knocked off his propeller. The next one, I got right in the middle of his gas tank, and he blew up. And then a third one came in, and somehow or other, I just cut off his tail. You know, I cut it right off.
Brother.
I guess I went sour after that. I missed the fourth one.
Yeah? Well, isn't that too bad? Well, do you want to stand around and cry about it? Or should we go and get that steak?
At the bomber bases, aboard our warships, and on the front lines with the ground forces, United Press correspondents are gathering the news, the colorful, exciting stories of United Nations fighting men in action. Be sure to hear the next program of Soldiers of the Press over this same station. Your local announcer will give you the time of that broadcast in just a moment. And meanwhile, remember to listen for United Press news on the air. look for United Press dispatches in your favorite newspaper. They are your guarantee of the world's best coverage of the world's biggest news.
For our next program, we're going to lighten the mood a little bit and listen to Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis in an episode of the Seal Test Variety Theater from 1949.
Seal Test presents Seal Test Variety Theater. Yes, it's Seal Test Variety Theater with Henry Russell and his orchestra, the Crew Chiefs Quartet, one of the screen's truly great actors, Charles Laughton, and two young men who in a short time have left a trail of fans in every city in which they have performed, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. And now here she is, our gal Thursday, the singing star of our show, Dorothy L'Amour.
Hi, this is Dottie, and thanks a lot. It's sure nice of all of you to join us tonight.
Well, excuse me, but can you tell us in which studio the Dorothy L'Amour show is?
Well, who wants to know?
Dean Martin.
And Jerry Lewis.
You came to the right place. This is the Seal Test Variety Theater, and I'm Dorothy L'Amour.
Well, hello, Dottie.
Hiya, Dottie.
Permit me to say you look lovely and glamorous tonight.
Why shouldn't I? I'm wearing my best suit.
Right, I was talking to Dottie.
Thanks, Gene. It's sweet of you to say that.
I might have known. This guy never says anything nice about me.
Look, boys, I want you to be on your best behavior tonight. We're expecting a very distinguished guest.
And who's that?
Charles Laughton.
You mean Chuck? Imagine that. Chuck is coming over.
Imagine that. Chuck is coming over.
Good old Chuck.
Good old Chuck. Hey, Dean.
What is it?
Who's Chuck?
I'm Chuck. Chuck Laughton, sometimes known as Charles Laughton.
Hello, Charles. It's real nice of you to drop over.
Thank you, Dorothy. It's real nice being here.
Charles, do you know Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis?
Know them. Why, when you boys were entertaining at Slapsy Max's, I was there every night.
Are you for real? Gee, are you really a fan of ours, Mr. Laughton?
Why, certainly. I go to nightclubs every night in the week.
Well, what do you do on a Monday night? They're closed, you know.
That doesn't bother me. I found a substitute.
What do you do?
I get into the broom closet with my radio. I shut the door, fill the closet with cigar smoke. I rumble furiously. And every 10 minutes, I open the door and throw out a $20 bill.
Thank you, Dottie, Martin and Lewis, and Charles Laughton. And now a few words from the man in charge of the Word to the Wise department.
Get the best, get Seal Test ice cream eclairs.
Wherever you go, folks echo the praises of
Seal Test ice cream eclairs.
Eclairs.
They're simply wonderful.
Derful.
See what I mean?
Why not try one tonight?
I will.
It's a treat you'll repeat again and again. Smooth Seal Test ice cream heaped on fudge-covered cake, a frosting of dark, rich chocolate, and to top it all off, snowy peaks of whipped cream. For a brand new taste sensation, look for the red and white Seal Test symbol and
get the best, get Seal Test ice cream declares.
Here's a tune that's been on my list of favorites for a dozen years or so. It's way up at the top of the list again, and I hope you like it.
The snow is snowing, the wind is blowing, but I can weather the storm. Why do I care how much it may storm? I've got my love to keep me warm. I can't remember a worse December. Just watch those icicles form. What do I care if icicles form? I've got my love to keep me warm. Off with my overcoat, off with my gloves. I need no overcoat, I'm burning with love. My heart's on fire, the flame grows higher, so I will weather the storm. Why do I care how much it may storm? I've got my love to keep me warm.
Yes, I've got my love to keep me warm.
Well, Dottie, what happens now?
Charles, if you have your grease paint on, it's time for us to do our little sketch.
I'm quite ready. I've been out in the wings rehearsing like mad.
In that case, John Lang, will you set the scene?
As the curtain goes up on the next act of the Seal Test Variety Theater, we see the Simpsons at breakfast. Dorothy and Charles Simpson are a much-married couple. The honeymoon was over long, long ago.
Dear.
What is it now?
Could I have a little more coffee?
Get it yourself.
Thank you, dear. Darling, there's something I'd love.
Well?
It's just that I'd better not.
For heaven's sake, out with it. What do you want?
Could I look at part of the paper?
Men. You're all alike, just selfish.
But I
won't. No!
But I'd like to know what's going on in the world. Did anything happen this morning?
Oh, you just don't let me have a minute's peace. There's nothing in the morning's paper at all.
Well, there must be something.
Oh, there's just some gruesome story here about a man in Cincinnati who was convicted of killing his wife with a meat cleaver.
Are they going to execute him?
No, and leave me alone.
I suppose he'll get life.
No. He was sentenced to 10 years in jail.
10 years isn't so long.
Oh, look at this at the Stauffer Clothing Company. A wonderful sale of suits.
You're so good to think of me, dear. I could certainly use a new suit.
These are women's suits.
Oh.
Well, stop dawdling. You just have time to catch the 8 o'clock bus.
Yes, it's time to go to work. Goodbye, dear. Aren't you going to kiss me goodbye, dear?
Oh, stop talking nonsense. And remember that list of things I want you to bring home.
Yes, dear. Bobby pins, green silk thread, a yard of elastic, toothpaste, and some food for the goldfish.
And don't dare forget a single one of those things.
No, dear. Goodbye.
And don't forget this is payday. Remember, bring home that pay envelope and don't tamper with it.
Yes, dear. Goodbye.
Dishes, dishes, dishes. I never saw a man use so many dishes in my life. I must have used 3 of them this morning. Come in.
Oh, hello, Dorothy. I thought I'd drop in and smoke a cigarette before I do my breakfast dishes. What's new?
Oh, nothing. It's Charles and his lack of consideration. I have to get up every morning. The least he could do is eat breakfast out. But I'm going to start laying down the law.
Look, Dorothy, I don't like to butt into anybody else's business. But between us girls, I think Charles is a very good husband.
What are you talking about?
Well, you know that Blanche Adams who lives in the corner house? Well, it seems that her husband got a little fed up with her nagging. And last week, Blanche sent him to the store to do some shopping, and do you know what?
What?
He never came home.
Oh, that's awful.
Say that again.
You know something? Maybe Charles isn't so bad after all.
That's what I keep trying to tell you. As a matter of fact, if I were you, when he comes home tonight, I'd be very sweet to him. And I'd be sure...
Are you sure you want another one?
Yes, bartender, and make this one straight. Like I was saying, there's just so much a man can stand. Since the day I was married, I've handed her my pay envelope every week without even opening it.
You really mean that you've never opened your own pay envelope?
It's the truth. I've had this job for 20 years and I still don't know how much money I make.
But, don't you know if you ever gotten a raise?
Well, I think I got one last April.
How could you tell?
Well, I remember that when she opened the envelope, she smiled. I'm telling you, a man can just stand so much. All day long, I work at a desk, and when I get home, I have to do the housework. I've gotten so ashamed to go anywhere without wearing gloves.
Why?
Dishpan hands.
You don't mean to tell me she makes you wash the dishes.
Oh, no. I kept myself shaving this morning, and do you know what came out?
What?
Lux, Rinso, and Dust. That woman treats me terribly.
You can say what you want about women, but you can't live without them.
I'd certainly like to try.
Hey, don't you think you better start for home? It's 8:30.
8:30. Every night for 20 years I've gotten home at 6 sharp, but tonight I'm going to get home plenty late, and I don't care what she says. Give me another drink. Hello.
Darling, come in. Let me take your coat.
Here.
Sweetheart, you've been drinking.
You said it.
Well, I hope you had a good time, and I've kept your dinner warm for hours.
No one needs dinner.
Then you don't have to eat it. Here, sit down in this comfortable chair. There. And here's the evening paper. I didn't even open it. What are you looking for, dear?
Matches. I haven't got any matches.
Well, just you sit right where you are. I'll light your pipe for you. There. Oh, you look so comfortable in that big, cozy chair. Darling.
What?
Can I sit on your lap?
I suppose so.
Oh, you're so big and strong. Honey, won't you put your arms around me?
All right.
Darling, aren't you going to give me a big kiss?
Might as well. I'll get the devil when I get home anyway.
Thank you, Charles Lawton. It was swell of you to stop in, and if you ever want to drop in again, remember, the front door's always open. In the meantime, we'll all be looking forward to seeing you in the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer production, The Bribe.
Get the biscuit seal test, ice cream eclairs.
Frankly, Dottie, how do you like Seal Test's new ice cream eclairs?
Well, frankly, all I can say is,
Meaning?
Marvelous.
That it is, Dottie. Famous Seal Test ice cream heaped on fudge-covered cake. A coating of rich chocolate topped with big dots of whipped cream. It's a brand new taste sensation that's...
Marvelous.
And every delicious bite is famous Seal Test quality. Tops in fine flavor, creamy rich texture, and pure goodness. For a wonderful mouth-melting treat, stop at your Seal Test dealers and...
Get the best, get Seal Test.
And now, before Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis return, our own Dottie steps up to the microphone and sings only as Dottie can sing, Hold Me.
Honey, won't you hold me? Hold me. Never let me go. this life you alone can do. Hold me tenderly and hold me. Never try to hold me from you.
I'd be contented if you consented to thrill me.
Just let your kisses thrill me.
Kisses to thrill me just like you.
Like you alone can.
Nobody ever could thrill me like you.
Hold me. Never try to hold me from you.
Never try to hold me from
you. Ah, Dolly, that was swell. And now, returning to the microphone through the courtesy of NBC and Paramount Pictures, we give you those two new comedians soon to be seen in the Hal Wallace production, My Friend Irma, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
If you got it, you don't need it. Come on, Dean, sing. If you need it, you don't got it. Dean, where are you? You don't get it. Shame on you. Dean, I'm soloing. Funny, 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 how bad can I sing? Dean.
Oh, why should I sing? There was no music.
Oh, so you're the kind of a singer who needs help.
Yeah, and you're the kind of a singer who's beyond help.
I'm beyond help. You just keep ridiculing me, Dean Martin, and you'll see, boy, oh, boy, wow, oh, I'll say. You'll just break up the team, that's what.
Oh, Jerry, I'm not trying to break up the team. Why, I like it. When I get a nightclub date, where could I get another guy to do the jokes? When I get sick, where could I get another guy to take care of me? When I get a double date, where could I get another guy to take the ugly one?
Yeah, I can't understand it, Dean. I always get the ugly ones, and yet at night when I dream of beautiful girls, too.
You dream of beautiful girls, too?
Sure, I dream about all kinds. Short, tall, fat, thin. And I dream of one certain girl who's short and tall and fat and thin all at the same time.
Jerry, how could you possibly dream of a girl who's short and tall and fat and thin all at the same time?
Well, she's anxious to please. But sometimes, Dean, when I'm real lucky, I dream about my ideal girl. Boy...
Your ideal girl?
Yes, I've seen her so many times. I know her exact measurements.
Well, what does she look like?
Well, she's,
Say, boys, I'm sorry I had to leave you by yourselves for a few moments, but now that I'm back, I... Jerry, what are you staring at?
No, no. You can't be. It's impossible.
What's the matter with him, Dean?
Oh, don't mind Jerry. He's all right. It's, he's just that, he's got an ingrown head.
Hey, that's not true. How could I have an ingrown head?
Look, Jerry, didn't it ever strike you as funny that they call your family doctor Old Butterfingers?
But why are you staring at me like that, Jerry?
I'm staring at the script like that.
I was just talking about my ideal dream girl, and there you are.
Oh. Well, Jerry, I couldn't be.
Yes, you are, Dorothy. You're exactly the same. Would you mind if I took a few measurements to prove it?
Well, I guess it would be all right.
You know, fortunately, I just happen to have a mink tape measure with me.
A mink tape measure?
Well, we've been doing very well lately. All right, Jerry, let's begin at the top. First, head circumference.
Yeah, head. 12.5 inches.
All right, around the neck.
Neck, 14 inches.
All right, shoulders.
Shoulders, 27.25.
Ankles.
Ankles. Ankles? What happened to June, July, and August? Come on, you're not doing it right.
Oh, Gerald, my sweet. Put that silly tape measure away. Why carry on this farce any longer? We both know we were made for each other.
You mean?
Yes.
Me too.
You knew?
Instantly.
You're completely and utterly irresistible.
Yes, I know. And there's something I must ask you.
Yes.
After the show, would you...
Yes.
Would you possibly...
Yes.
Would you come to my dressing room?
Oh, yes, Gerald. Yes, yes.
Superb. And be sure and bring your jackknife. Of course, I've sneaked in some dirt and we'll have a swell game of Mumbly Peg for two and two for Mumbly Peg. Me for you. Sharpen up your blade so we can play. We can play alone.
Stop it. Always you gotta make like an imbecile.
What?
Dean's right, Jerry. Absolutely right.
Oh, cahooties. You and Dean are ganging up on me, huh? Well, go ahead, push me around, abuse me, kick me, sure. There's just one thing I want you to know. When a boy of my type makes a race indelible impression on a girl or a jackknife, it's not easy for people to say that I'm one to conclude my feelings gesturing whether one has the opportunity to feel more or less on the same plane as I am. I'm wondering whether there's any chance of seeing for no one else.
Jerry, there's just one thing I don't understand.
What's that?
Are you for real? Thanks, Jerry Lewis. And here's Dean Martin singing one of his latest Capitol recordings, Tara, Talara, Talar.
Oh, Daddy made out this lullaby just to sing it to you. Soon as you learn this lullaby, you can sing it to your dolly too. Ta-ra, ta-la-ra, ta-la. Play peek-a-boo. Star, hush you by baby when shadows creep. Dreamland is not very far. Ta-ra, ta-la-ra, ta-la-ra. Just like the angel you are. Rock-a-bye, baby, now you're asleep. Ta-da, ta-la-da, ta-la. Ta-da, ta-la-da, ta-la.
Wonderful. Don't go away, folks, because in just a moment we're going to give you news about a great lineup for next week.
Ever notice how often you find a son who is taller and bigger than his father? Yes, the soldiers in World War II averaged a full inch taller than the soldiers of 1917. That shows how much we're learning about diet. So many of the things it takes to build strong bodies are in milk and milk products. Nature's most nearly perfect food is still a bargain. Here at National Dairy, we're searching always for better and less expensive ways to process and provide you with milk and milk products. Each month, key men from our company serving communities throughout the country get together at National Dairy to discuss how we can improve our service to the consumer. These men have years of experience. Experience which is used to help keep costs low and National Dairy products high in quality. And here again is your mistress of ceremonies, Dottie L'Amour.
Well, I hope you're all with us again next Thursday because we're going to have the old professor, Kay Kaiser, and Brian Donlevy, the co-star of my current United Artists picture, Lucky Stiff. To Charles Lawton, Dean Martin, and Jerry Lewis, I'm sending an orchid to each of you for the wonderful job you did tonight. Your appearance here contributes to a fine cause, the establishment of the American Federation of Radio Artists Welfare Insurance Fund. And while we're thinking of fine causes,
Here's John Lang with a few words about a cause that's close to all of us.
This is National Heart Week, and the American Heart Association is in full swing in the fight against heart disease. Ask your local Heart Association for literature and information. The more you know, the less you fear. Work, fight, and give for the American Heart Association's 1949 goal of $5 million for research, education, and community service.
We can to help. Well, the clock says it's time to drop the curtain in another performance of the Seal Test Variety Theater. So till next Thursday, then, for Henry Russell and the orchestra, the Crew Chiefs Quartet, and tonight's guests, this is Dorothy L'Amour saying, we'll be thinking of you.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Henry Russell and his orchestra. Tonight's Seal Test Variety Theater was written by Howard Harris, Sidney Zelenka, Ray Allen, and Dick McKnight. Direction was by Glenn Hall Taylor. Tune in next Thursday at the same time when Seal Test again presents Seal Test Variety Theater, starring Dorothy L'Amour and as our guests, Brian Donlevy and Kay Kaiser. Seal Test Incorporated and Associate Companies are divisions of National Dairy Products Corporation. This is John Lang speaking.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Our time is up, but we'll be back next week with more, so join us then. This is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.